Welcome to the second episode of Side Pod Chat, the show where we just sit and talk about F1 for hours on end. The first episode was so popular that we are back once again with five more callers on the line. We've got Journia.
Hello.
Ollie.
Hey, everybody.
Scott.
Hello.
Gavin.
Hi.
And Andy.
Hello.
As I said, the premise is simple. We come up with topics and hear what everyone has to say about them. The last show went on for a bit, didn't it?
It went on a little bit too much, actually. But I think part of that was my fault.
Oh, really?
Because I got slightly digressed into the realm of sports cars. And we definitely don't want to, you know, we want to keep it F1. And we want to keep it tight and we want to keep it snappy. So
absolutely,
this week we're going to keep it a little bit tighter and totally focus on F1.
Good. So do we have a topic to start with?
I do, actually. Top of the list, Bordeaux, racing in Formula 1 and also in Le Mans. Can he do it?
So already you're going off topic.
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Right.
Just to get it out of the way to start with. We will try and keep it a little bit snappier, a little bit tighter, and try and keep it under the 2-hour mark because, you know, it's going to kill our server, if nothing else. Righty-ho. Seriously, though, first question I would be interested to know people's thoughts on Bordeaux. Is he taking on too much? The guy had no drives at the beginning of the year, potentially no prospects for racing whatsoever. Now he's got Formula 1 drive. He's doing Sebring in a couple of weeks, and then he's doing Le Mans in the summer. Anybody want to take a stab at, is it a good idea? Or is he taking a bit off more than he can chew?
Yeah. I think if the drivers were able to do it before, then I don't see any reason why they can't do it now. Actually, it's a great part. It's a great thing to do on the part of Bordeaux to take part in both F1 and Le Mans. It's a very admirable thing to do because nowadays drivers tend to be limited in their disciplines. If they're like, you know, if they're focusing on F1, they just stay with F1. Or if they're focusing on Le Mans, they stay with Le Mans. And they probably have a good reason for that. But at the same time, it's a bit boring from our perspective and from their perspective because they don't, you know, they're not really able to fully maximize their skills in different forms of racing because F1 and Le Mans are two completely different racing disciplines. So the only downside for this I see is Bordeaux will not be able to fully prepare for Le Mans. But then again, they are also, you know, they're performing as a team. There's going to be three drivers. So they're also probably going to be able to balance the load well enough so for them to still have a very good shot at winning. So if Bordeaux would win Le Mans this year, which is a real possibility, yeah, that would be fantastic, both from his perspective, because that means he's a good driver, but at the same time from a general perspective, because that would then encourage other drivers to start looking at also racing in multiple disciplines, like both F1 and Le Mans.
Kathy's just pointed out in the comments that she wants Kimi to do the Finland rally as well. So that's taking on another series.
That would be a completely different discipline. He's talked about doing that after he's finished Formula 1, but she'd like to see him do it now whilst he's racing. Does it make a difference that Kimi has the potential to be driving for the World Drivers title and Bordeaux really doesn't? So Bordeaux has less to lose than Kimi in that respect.
Bordeaux's got a lot more to prove because of what happened last year. I mean, a lot of people don't take his kart titles as seriously as he would like to, because some people view Champ Car or kart as not as good as it used to be. So it's just another series title rather than something pretty well. The thing with Bordeaux, he's racing in a Peugeot 908 sports car. And a couple of drivers, I can't remember who it was exactly, said that driving those cars, it's very, very similar to driving a Formula 1 car. So from that perspective, he wouldn't be doing something that different to Formula 1, just a lot longer. And Kimi, by doing a rally, would be doing something that's quite a bit of a different discipline.
Gotcha, yep.
So I would say that Bordeaux's got more to gain than he has to lose from going to Le Mans, because if he does badly, then people will probably not take much notice of it. But if he does well, then people will probably take a lot more notice of it because it's Le Mans.
Going on from that point, Scott, what do you reckon? Should F1 drivers, obviously in the past, Formula 1 drivers used to do a lot of disciplines. They were racing Formula 1, and because the money was lower than it is now, they'd have to make up the shortfall by racing elsewhere. Do you think we should see more of that in Formula 1?
I don't see why not. I mean, you know, one example that comes to mind when I think of drivers in Formula 1 and Le Mans the same year is Eddie Irvine. In 1993 and 1994, he drove for Toyota, but also in the same years, he drove for Jordan Formula 1. So, I mean, if people like Eddie Irvine, also Bordeaux can manage to do it, because obviously he can do it now because the testing rules have been coming to force, so there's pretty much nothing for them to do in the summer. You know, I think F1 drivers should look to other other formulas to try and keep themselves occupied. I mean, and to try and maybe earn themselves a bit more money on the side. I mean, you know, drivers like maybe, yes, you know, some of the drivers in the lower teams could maybe do so to try and get a bit more experience on different areas of motorsport, maybe rather than just Formula One. But yeah, I don't see why other drivers couldn't do it. I mean, it would be quite exciting to see drivers like Massa or Hamilton or something like that competing at you know, at Le Mans or maybe in other sports car series.
In the comments, Steve Moy said it would be good with no in-season testing. Obviously, it's good to get every mile that you can under your belt.
I'm wondering how this came about, because Bourdais is driving a Peugeot and yet he's driving a Ferrari engine car. They don't like drivers to stray outside their group of manufacturers. For example, Kimi had to drive an Abarth in the Lapland rally because it was a Fiat group car, like the Ferrari is.
Was it not the case that Bourdais signed up for this when he didn't think, well, at least when he thought he may not have a Formula One drive?
Could well be. But I'm sure if Toro Rosso knew about it, it probably didn't help with the negotiation with them. They'd already signed up with another manufacturer. Maybe it doesn't matter so much because it's Toro Rosso, but for example, if he was a Renault driver, for example, I doubt they'd be very happy about it driving for a Peugeot.
No.
Because they're rivals on and off the track.
So. Absolutely, yes. That's a very good point. Do you think that's part of the reason why we don't see so much of this nowadays? Because of this, the fact drivers are tied to manufacturers and manufacturers don't like to see them straying beyond those boundaries?
Yeah, because it's not just manufacturers, but it's sponsors like the fuel company, the main sponsor. You, it's not feasible for you to be an ambassador, for example, for one brand and then race for another team in something else that represents your rival brand. It wouldn't be viewed favorably. For example, in NASCAR, let's say a driver is sponsored by Coke. If he wins a race sponsored by Pepsi, he has to drink the Pepsi in the winner's circle, and then he ends up getting fined by Coke for drinking the rival's product.
Sure.
So if he doesn't drink, then he goes, so it's okay, so I won't drink the Pepsi. So if he doesn't drink the Pepsi, then the race organizers fine him for not honoring the sponsor of the race. Could well be that part of the problem we don't see it as much is because of sponsor conflict.
It is tricky, isn't it? Lou's also pointed out in the comments, does it have to be racing? Because Jensen enters triathlons, but then Mark Webber didn't do so well in his extracurricular event. So maybe there's an element of they don't want their drivers doing too much that might get them hurt.
You'd imagine that from Ferrari with Kimi doing rallies. He certainly put himself, I guess, at risk. When he did the snowmobile race, that was certainly risky, wasn't it? So there is a small amount of that. I don't know whether Jensen really counts, though, because at the moment he doesn't have a drive.
He still counts.
I mean, last year he did triathlons. So
it still counts as an example.
It does, yes. Fair enough. But if he signed himself up to a bunch of triathlons this year, you couldn't blame him, could you? Because at the moment he has nothing else to do. It's unknown, which nicely leads us on to the hot topic of the week. I tried to put it off with some sports car talk.
Honda.
It's dominated the comments.
Is it possible to go without talking about them?
No.
Okay.
Not if we were being true and fair. Ollie, thoughts on Honda and Richard Branson? It's all but a done deal, isn't it?
Well, we all thought it was a done deal, didn't we? But Richard Branson then sort of like was very vague in his interviews, wasn't he? And lots of speculation going around about it's not a done deal now. And he's just looking for free advertising, basically, which sort of doesn't paint him well in Formula One circles if it's all a sort of a big hoax, if you like. I'm, to be honest, completely confused as to whether or not it is going to go ahead now. But if it doesn't go ahead, then my concern for the team just gets even more heightened because it's just getting so close to the season. And I think that's almost too late, really, to do anything. I don't know. I hope that they can do something, but I just think it's too late now.
It's too close to call. I mean, they've had rumours have been around, and obviously we've got nothing to go on but rumours at the moment. Rumours have been around that they've got a Mercedes engine to install into their car. So in theory, they should have a KERS system fitted. Whether or not it's their KERS system, whether or not it's a nice fit and a snug fit, or whether it's literally just been bolted into the back and it runs, and that's as far as they've got.
I think KERS is the least of their problems right now.
Well, it is and it isn't, because that was their ace in up their sleeve, wasn't it? It was a thing that it was going to pull them up, you know.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter if they're not going to be there.
That's a fair point. I mean, they've got they should have some form of engine in the back of their car to power them. Rumours were about last week that trucks were heading to Dover, but we don't know why. We don't know if they're going for a test. We don't know if it's some kind of marketing thing or whether they're just being sent to the scrap heap. Absolutely nobody knows anything about it.
Well, the news today is Bernie saying that he offered them £100 million.
I haven't looked into the story.
Or dollars.
I haven't had a chance.
And they
the
turned
word?
It down.
What? Who turned it down? Nick Fry?
There isn't much been said other than that Bernie offered help and Nick Fry turned him down.
Do we know why?
Would you want Bernie as your team owner?
No.
I mean, look what he did to Brabham. Look what he did to Brabham. He bought a decent team, and after they stopped being successful, he kind of got bored and then went on to do running the Formula One, making money business, and sort of dropped the team. If he bought Honda, first of all, Nick Fry would be gone, because I doubt that those two would get along. Second of all, I don't think he'd run it with the interest of the team at heart. He'd run it with the interest of making money off it, stuff like the TV deal and things like that. And also, he'd use it to get a wedge into the FOTA association, because he'd be technically part of FOTA. And yet again, we'd have somebody running Formula One on the side of the teams and the authorities.
What do you make of the Frank Williams? Well, it wasn't an outburst, was it? But on Friday, he said he was unhappy with the wind tunnel restrictions. And suddenly, he's the first guy to effectively break ranks from FOTA. He's the first guy to speak out against FOTA. And he's not happy that they're restricting the wind tunnel test when Williams have a pretty good wind tunnel. Is that anything to do with the fact that Bernie recently gave him a bit of cash?
No, I think I read that comment from Frank Williams, and I immediately thought the reason why he's saying that is because he's paid a lot of money for that second wind tunnel and decided to go that way instead of that CFD computer simulation stuff.
Mm.
And now he's being told he has to shut down the wind tunnel. And he'd have to spend all the money on CFD, presumably, to make up for that gap. And of course you'd be unhappy when you were told that, because you've not only have you spent the money, you've geared up to use it, and he's hired aerodynamicists and so on. And it's a small team with not that much spare money, so it'd be more expensive than it would be cost-cutting for him.
Makes sense. Andy, what do you reckon of this Honda, ex-Honda / Bernie deal? Do you think Bernie was trying to buy his way into FOTA?
I think that's a very possible reason. The story seems to have broken in a certain Sunday tabloid with a red top. they actually say that the management buyout would have ensured that the team competed this year. So that's 100 million quid is enough to run the team for the season. But it would have given Bernie a say in FOTA. Braun and Fry would each have owned 17.5% of the team. It doesn't say how much Bernie gets.
Right.
Or would have got, rather. But the quote from Bernie is, if we lost a McLaren or a Ferrari or someone like BMW, people would wonder what's going on. But I don't think that will be the case with Honda. They didn't do too much last year, did they?
He has a point.
Yeah, he wants to buy them for £100 million. Well, invest £100 million and to keep them going.
Well, he has a point up until the fact that, actually, yes, we all do want to know what's going on. And we do care.
Yes. Do you think he's doing it to save... Rather, ignoring the photo point for a moment then, do you think he's not doing it to save the sport? If he needs a full grid, he needs that many cars to turn up in Melbourne, he needs a full grid of people competing, he needs to make Formula 1 look needs to basically present Formula 1 as a healthy-looking sport. Do you think he's not doing it for that reason?
Maybe he is, but it does kind of smack a bit of desperation, doesn't it? Look, I've taken all your money, I'm the only one who can reach into my back pocket and hand over enough money to run the team. For a year, it does seem a bit like a pat on the head to Fry and Braun, and sort of, there you go, boys, go off and play. The fringe benefits are that he gets a full grid. I'm not sure he's that bothered either way.
What do you make of it, Scott? What do you think Bernie's up to here?
Well, I'm just reading here on the story. Apparently, it says that one of the reasons he wanted Honda to stay in the sport because he wanted Bruno Senna in the second car. He said it would be fantastic to have Senna have the Senna name back in Formula One. Apparently, but
really,
he says,
do you believe that?
Yeah, that's part of the story.
Apparently, what he says is that Brian Ross Braun apparently rejected his offer because they wanted to do things on their own. Now, really, if you're looking at that really takes them down the route of the management takeover, and that's only one of three options they've got, which is either going down the Virgin route, which is taking Richard Branson's offer. The management buyout for themselves, or just pulling out Formula One altogether. And don't forget that they have said that's still an option for them. So But I don't know. I mean, I'm not. I have no idea what Blaney was trying to do with Honda. I mean, whether he was trying to turn it into another Brabham where he lorded over them and tried to bring innovative ideas in it or not, I'm not sure. But whether he genuinely wants to save Honda because it'll help out the sport and it'll help out the team, I'm not sure. But we all know that Blaney is a bit deluded, so.
It might be that he doesn't have a specific plan, but he just sees it as a good business investment. That's what happens in a recession, isn't it? You just buy everyone up as they go out of business.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it works for the banks, then it should work for Formula One teams in the afternoon.
What do you think then of the Richard Branson story? Bernie's obviously said this a no-go, and nobody wants his money, and he's not getting his hands on the team. So that basically gives you Virgin and bust. So what do you make of the Virgin option? Do you think it can go ahead, or is it just marketing gone crazy?
It's looking a lot like fluff, you know. It's because they're, you know, they're what I think what it's looking like, at least if this isn't a real bid, it's more like what I see it happening is, you know, they were rumored to be connected, and at first they wanted to deny it, but then they realized that it had given them free publicity, so why don't they just go along for the ride, you know? At the rate it's looking, I am not very optimistic that we will see a Virgin F1 car or team come Melbourne. However, on the other hand, what it's looking like is the question I do want to ask is, if you remember, Pit Pass released an article, I think it was last week, you know, where they said that it was Honda that approached Virgin, not the other way around. So does this mean that Honda are looking for other buyers and are just looking at the management buyout as a, you know, as a final option?
That's a good point.
Because they are thinking Virgin would have more cash. Virgin might actually be willing to pay them more than the management buyout.
So you think they might have gone cold on the management buyout?
Well, actually, since we're on Honda, and I do want to touch very quickly on the what you were talking about Bernie, you know, about Bernie spending money on the £100 million buyout for Honda. Two things that surprised me. Number one, we're actually talking about a News of the World article. I know they were the paper that, you know, that started the whole Max thing this time last year, but still, I mean, this is News of the World, so we have to take what they're saying with a grain of salt. That's the first thing. Second, if it is true, and Bernie, you know, and Bernie is looking to buy, you know, to get a stake in Brackley F1, and Ross Brawn and Nick Frye said no, it tells me a couple of things. First, it looks like, you know, where would they get the cash? If they're not getting it from Bernie, they have to be getting that kind of cash from somewhere. Where are they getting it from? I want to know that. Number two, it means that they are actually talking to FOTA on a, you know, or what kind of level, we don't know. But they are talking to FOTA, and they are putting a structure in place such that they will be working with them come Melbourne. And that makes it very interesting, because that means that they are willing to work with the other teams and really put up a united front. So it's really telling me how serious they are and how serious FOTA is in making it work against Bernie.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. Because they could have stabbed FOTA in the back, and they could have just said, yeah, we'll take Bernie's money and we'll pocket it, and we'll try that, and then we'll race around for 12 months, and then we'll see what happens this time next year. In the meantime, FOTA is basically, they're done and dusted. Do you think FOTA is a bit risky? Because, I mean, Bernie could potentially buy himself into any team, couldn't he? I mean, he's already got a bit of a shoe-in with Frank. I'm sure there are other people who would happily take his money and give him a seat on the bench.
I thought the Frank thing, the Williams thing, was that they just got their TV money ahead of time.
Yes, they did.
Still a favour, though, isn't it?
It is a favour, and you could argue that he potentially, Frank owes Bernie one.
Can I make a comment on Virgin?
Please do.
Richard Branson did this with Northern Rock. When Northern Rock were in the poo-poo, he suddenly stepped up and said, oh, I'll buy the bank, you know, have Virgin Banks and whatever. And then everyone said, sweet. And then a lot of things happened, and then he suddenly just pulled out and said, oh, the numbers weren't right. Do you think he's going to do this with Honda? And the reason why I said it is because you get someone like Virgin associated with you. Not only does it make the Honda team, not only does it raise their profile by, ooh, a big brand like Virgin must be interested in us, so it might put the price up, and it also benefits Virgin because now they're associated with Formula One, even if it doesn't go through.
That sounds very likely. If you had to put your cards on the table, do you think it's going to go, you think we're going to hear that Virgin are confirmed to buy Honda this week or not?
Before I went away on Friday, I would have said yes, and then I suddenly read a story on the BBC where he says all these things in Formula One have to change. It's too expensive. It's not green enough. He said a couple other things, and he said, until these things happen, I won't enter Formula One, which is pretty much saying either one of two things. One, Honda is asking for too much money, or two, he's starting and sowing the seeds to walk away from any negotiations.
Sounds like what ProDrive said, isn't it? Because Dave Richards said, yeah, I'm not entering until Formula One is respectable.
Why don't Virgin just sponsor the Ross Brawn Nick Fry team, whatever it is? If they're not willing to take on the responsibilities of team ownership, then perhaps it would just be better for them just to be like a title sponsor, for example, and then just get all the publicity without the downsides of real commitment. That way it also, which may also be a possible answer to where Ross Brawn and Nick Fry will get the $100 million money from. Perhaps Virgin is giving them a big deal of money as a possible sponsor. While it may or may not happen, at least, you know, it would probably make the team stronger as a whole if it's still Ross Brawn running the team, rather than someone that, you know, Richard Branson would just appoint.
Yeah, we haven't heard what his plans are. I don't think there's been any speculation about what Richard's plans would be if he bought the team, because are we assuming that Fry would be out on his ear? Are we assuming that Brawn would be gone? Anybody got any speculation as to what the plans might be should Virgin take on that challenge?
The thing is, though, is that Virgin have no experience of motor racing in the past, as far as I'm aware. They've never won a team before.
Nope.
So if Richard Branson were to buy the team and he wanted to replace staff, especially the critical staff, the key members of staff like Nick Fry or Ross Brawn, who's he going to replace them with? And who's on the market right now? Who's available? The only person I can really think of is perhaps Nigel Stepney, but I don't think he's allowed and one would want him.
Mike Coughlin must be free too.
Yeah. I don't see how the Virgin Group could suddenly replace these people, even if they wanted to, straight away. It might be the case that if they did take over the team, they would just try and get by for a year while everything settled down and they sorted out the management structure. But I think it's very difficult for a company that has no experience of motor racing to suddenly get involved from the off and get it working straight away.
It does. That sounds right on the money. They have no racing pedigree. They have no history. They've done a little bit of sponsorship, and Richard's turned up at a couple of Grand Prix in the past, but presumably as a motor racing fan, rather than somebody who's actually interested in purchasing a stake. I like Joni's idea that they might just be a sponsor, though.
Well, like you said, Richard Branson doesn't have any experience with Formula One team ownership, so I think sponsorship would really be the only, I guess, would be a sensible option to go for. But, you know, but in terms of you know what he'd do with the team, I really don't see why he wants to get rid of Ross Brawn. He saw what kind of impact he had when he joined Ferrari at the beginning of 1997. You know, and since then, he's basically kind of been one of the big, you know, one of the big four, one of the big five in the team, which took them to all the world championships. If it was down to me, I'd get rid of Nick Fry because regardless of what people say, I just don't think that really he should be at Honda anymore. Because personally, when Dave Richards took over the team, before about, I think it was 2001, 2002, since then they kind of steadily moved up the order, and they even got to the point where Jenson was second in the championship 2004. But then when Nick took over in 2006, yes, they won a race, but that was kind of them getting lucky with the weather and the strategy. Apart from that, Honda's just gone downhill. I mean, what exactly major have they achieved that hasn't been just down to luck of the draw or the weather? I can't really see why how they've done that, and I don't really see why Nick Fry should be in that team anymore. I mean, the Earth Dreams kind of concept, yes, maybe they were serious about the environmental thing, but I don't think it really probably was just a marketing ploy, I think. You know, just to get some publicity, and then you can see what happened with the car, because in 2007 the car was just dreadful, probably one of the worst Formula One cars ever, and it showed that it was never reliable, it was never on the pace. And 2008, yeah, they got a lucky podium at the Silverstone, but that was only because, you know, Ross Brawn, you know, made the call, the strategy to go to extreme wets when the weather turned bad. Apart from that, they were absolutely nowhere. And I think I personally blame most of that off to Nick Fry, because I'm not sure exactly what kind of, you know, major decisions he made, but I don't think they were for the best interests of the drivers like Button and Barrichello.
Sure.
And for the actual car and the actual performance of the car, I think it was only down to the team and how much kind of, you know, promotion they could get from the team, how much maybe some money they could bring in, everything. But I just don't really see you know, why Nick Wright should stay in the team.
So the question is, if he and Ross Brawn take over the team, are they just going to run it into the ground if Nick Fry is still involved?
Well, I mean, I would hope that maybe they've seen the error of their ways since Nick took over. I think Ross Brawn needs to, you know, seriously sit down and talk with Nick and say to him, look, this is the, let's look at what you've achieved, what you've majorly achieved since you took over in 2006. And you can see that apart from a maiden win, it's been nothing. And then you need to look at, in contrast, if you look at what Ross Brawn's achieved, he's achieved and basically brought Ferrari up from, say, what they were, a midfield team, back up to their former glory, and they won multiple championships. So you really can't argue between the two. So I think really, if I was honest, I think Ross should maybe take a more senior role than Nick, because in fairness, you know, looking at what both guys have achieved, Ross knows what he's doing more than Nick does.
Mr. C raised earlier that Virgin have no experience in Formula One. Well, neither does Vijay Mallya before he started, or Red Bull, or a lot of other big sponsors or team owners. I don't think it's necessarily a prerequisite to have experience. Someone like Richard Branson, he's an entrepreneur, he's a very good businessman. He would either know who he'd need in his team or have the people that could research who he'd need in his team. And if he was to buy the team, he would put in the people that he knew would make a good team. He wouldn't just do it, buy the team and let it carry on as it is.
The name we haven't mentioned yet is it Adrian Reynard, which was banded around at the beginning of last week. Who is he a business partner of Richard Branson's? And he used to design chassis for, was it BAR before Honda bought them?
So he's got someone he can trust.
Well, he's got someone who knows Formula One very close to him. He might be his next door neighbour, I think. He says off the top of his head without checking any facts. I believe that they're pretty close. So he might know more about Formula One than we're actually giving him credit for. Something I was going to mention just came back to me. Something on GrandPrix.com, which I'm glad you brought up the point you just did, Gavin, because what GrandPrix.com pointed out last week was that Red Bull have been doing very well since they came into Formula One. And apparently the company recently reported that in 2008 sales increased in every continent the Formula One was present in, and it decreased in the States. And therefore, if Red Bull are selling more drinks as a result of Formula One, and Virgin have an energy drinks brand, do you not think there's any chance that maybe Richard's looked at what Red Bull are doing and thought, well, maybe actually these are our competitors. I need to be in the space that they're competing in.
The thing with Virgin is you have to take a look at it from a more holistic point of view, because they have a lot of businesses. So energy drinks is just one arm of that whole set. And while it would be possible for Richard Branson to consider that and look at that, he would have to look at it from a more big picture perspective, if it's really worth getting into or not. Just a note though about, you know, if Branson really knows a lot about F1 compared to Dietrich Mateschitz, is, well, you have to consider that Mateschitz has been sponsoring in F1 since, I think, 1995 with Sauber, and he had been sponsoring drivers, you know, for, you know, remember the Enrique Bernoldi, Kimi Raikkonen mess up one. So I think he knows his stuff, and same goes for Vijay Mallya. He's been in F1 since, I think, 1997 with Benetton, and then he moved on to a lot of other teams. So he too also did his. He did his F1 experience beforehand. And these people, we know these people have really been interested in F1 for the longest time. And I mean, they're not really doing it out of business profit. They're really doing it because they really like the sport and they really want to play a role in it, play a part in it. And the business thing just came later. The passion or the, you know, their love for the sport was the first reason why they entered F1 in the first place. So, well, I'm not saying Branson wouldn't do a good job because he doesn't love the business as much. That's completely not true, because, as you said, they have Adrian Reynard there, and you know, and possibly, you know, the thing that would be interesting though is, in a battle of startups, you know, how would they fare against Force India, first of all, and second is, by next year, they need to beat, you know, if it especially pushes through, I want to bring this up as a new topic. They have to beat USF1 because they already have the infrastructure in place. If they have Reynard there and if they have Ross Brawn there, they should definitely be able to challenge in the, you know, to challenge probably at least, at the very least, in the lower midfield by next year.
we've seen that, you know, Richard Branson has said that, you know, oh, I'm not going to enter F1 because the time is not right, and, you know, and so have Pro Drive. But I've just been wondering whether you think, we're going to get something like this from US F1. I mean, they've all been talking that there's going to be a big team launch, and they're already, they're already touting Danica as a test driver and everything, and they're already looking at what they can do. But I'm just worried that it's because we kind of have the same kind of exact same thing with Pro Drive, where they're all ready to enter Formula One. They got the 12th spot, or the 11th spot to come into Formula One. And then they said, time's not right, and we're going to give it up. So I think we really need to, look at US F1 very closely and think, is this just another, another flash in the pan thing where they just, it's more guesswork than they're really going to.
Why do you think the timing isn't right for Richard at the moment, and it isn't right for Pro Drive? But suddenly it is right for US F1. Is it because the rules just aren't quite there for 2009, but they will be for 2010? And are US F1 putting too much faith into the FIA's regulations and the fact that they're all going to change and they're all going to be perfect for what they want next year?
I think that really one of the main things they might be doing is to try and kind of increase the popularity of Formula One in America. And they're probably thinking that, you know, if there's like an all American Formula One team with all American drivers and an American base, an American car, and maybe an American associated engine and all that, basically everything it's American associated, then the fan base in America will probably respond more to Formula One. In terms of the motorsport fan base as a whole, they might start responding more to Formula One than they would to say maybe IndyCar or dare I say it NASCAR. Yeah, but one thing which I did kind of think to myself is that because there's all these ovals around in America, around that kind of area, I'm just thinking, you just know that US F1 are going to be tempted to go and do some aerodynamic testing over on one of the ovals. Maybe like one of the nearest ones like Charlotte or something, and go and do some aerodynamic testing instead of going to some you know, disused like airfield or an airport or something and going and doing straight line testing. I mean, they've got all these ovals out there in America. Why not just go around there and run some laps around the ovals for a day or two?
Well, that wouldn't be very...
I should think it'd be blooming dangerous, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it wouldn't be very close to what you'd experience in F1, would it?
They're not designed to do that. I'm not sure you would end up killing yourself in a car that was designed to work on flat roads, wouldn't it?
Indy cars are single-seaters, and they run over just fine, and road courses. So the Formula 1 car can run on the banking of Indianapolis fine.
Good point.
You know, when they're running on the road course, I mean, yes, except 2005 when we had that whole tyre fiasco. But if it can run on an Indianapolis banking fine, now I don't see why it can't run on a full oval just fine.
So why do you think that they're building up such a large base in Spain? Because it sounds like all the design stuff is going to happen in the States, but they're not actually going to have a car over there. It's all going to be prototypes and CFD work. And then the bones of it are going to be put together in Spain.
I think maybe they're trying to do it over in Europe. Is that maybe because they're trying to get used to maybe the kind of circuits which are over there in Europe. I mean, they're kind of estranged to like any kind of proper road courses. So things like that, yes, they've got circuits like Laguna Seca and Road America, but I think the Americans really need to try their car out on places like, I don't know, but like Barcelona or Valencia or Jerez and things like that. I think really they need to gain some experience on proper road courses and, you know, and really see how the other teams go about working in an official test session and how they work about, you know, dealing with the warm climate and dealing with, you know, the kind of cores which they'd be looking at.
We have, what have we got left now? A day and a bit at the time of recording. 1 day, 15 hours remaining before the official announcement of US F1. What are you expecting? Will you be tuning in? And what are you most looking forward to?
Well, just to quickly go back to the comment earlier about the Formula One cars racing around ovals in America and the testing. The general consensus was, I think, that why can't a Formula One car drive around an oval? I understood it that Ralf Schumacher had an accident in his Toyota, I think it was 2004 maybe, or 2005, maybe in that accident, whereby the Toyota had trouble getting up onto the banking of the oval at the last corner, and that a lot of drivers kind of stayed lower down on the apron.
Yep.
Because of the angle of the banking, the cars just couldn't cope with it, and it was unloading or something and causing the car to have an accident. So I'm not sure that a Formula One car really can drive that well around an oval.
And they don't run high on the ovals at any point in Indy, do they? It's basically down low, and then they will just blend over the exit of the corner. Yeah. It's not a full circuit.
That's not entirely true. It depends on the track and on the conditions. There are drivers who, like Dale Earnhardt Jr. in NASCAR, who is known for taking the high line
Agreed, agreed. But Formula One cars don't, as Scott's original point was, I think that Formula One cars do run at Indy, which is true, but they never run on the full oval. They never run at the top of the oval either.
Yeah, and also the oval banking in Indy is actually very low for an oval. It's only right. 9 to 12 degrees or something, where there's some ovals have banking up to 30 degrees.
And could a Formula One car do that?
No.
And would it be any use if you ran a test car around on an oval in order to get some kind of straight line information?
Not for straight line information, no way. Because
it's not
you'd
a straight
have
line.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the load on the right hand side of the car. Supposing we're going around an oval the normal way, which is left turns, the load on the right hand side would be tremendous, and it would be so imbalanced, and you have to set up the car so incorrectly, you'd have no useful data to take back.
Okay, just come back to Ollie because we lost. You never got an answer to my question. What are you expecting on Tuesday?
To be honest, I don't really know quite what's going to happen on Tuesday. I will be tuning in to watch it. It's a really exciting story, and it's sort of captured the imagination of. Of racing fans the world over. America's coming back to Formula One, apparently. I honestly think it'll probably be a bit of an anticlimax on Tuesday. I think it's just going to be a press conference, and they've already got their logo, which is about as unimaginative as logos go. I think it's just going to be a simple press conference whereby they sort of officially say, yes, we are definitely going to enter Formula One next year. And I think that's going to be about it. I think the more excitement's going to come during 2009 as sort of details are leaked through as to what exactly USF1 are doing, who the driver's going to be, what the makeup of the team is going to be like. And then towards the off-season in 2009, that's when it's going to really get sort of like very hyped up. I don't think they've actually got any drivers to announce yet. I know Danica Patrick's been in the press an awful lot this past week. And then she turned around and said, well, I haven't had any contact with the team and the team haven't contacted me. But, you know. So I think it's going to be a bit of an anticlimax, to be honest. And I think it's going to get more and more interesting as the year goes on.
That sounds likely. Do you think we'll see them turn up at races?
During 2009?
Well, obviously Peter Windsor's going to be there because he's working for Speed, I guess. But I just wonder if you think they'll be turned up in an official capacity to do any kind of marketing or to do some kind of research or I don't know. Do you think if this many teams enter in 2010, is there going to be a problem with some of the garages? Is there enough room to get all these teams in if Max's 12 teams do sign up as he claims they will do?
Yeah,
before Junior starts, can I just make a very, very quick point? Sorry to interrupt. But Honda are supposed to have everything in theory wrapped up on the 23rd. USF1 are announcing their entry on the 24th. Coincidence?
I think yes, because I think Honda wanted to get their deal wrapped up by the end of December, and it's just been dragged on and on and on, and eventually they're just getting a little bit fed up of it. But I don't know. Do you not think it is?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is dragging on and on and on. The fact it's dragging on and on, I still think there's a connection. I mean, I hope to be proved wrong when it's announced and there's a Honda and a USF1. But just that fact, and the fact that this Branson Willie are warranty, and it's dragging on, and there's no clear buyer, and they're rejecting Bernie's money, it's all pointing towards something. And I believe that something is a connection with USF1.
Well, I think that's possible, but then it's almost guaranteed that USF1 will be based in Charlotte and in Spain. Honda is going to be based in Brackley, so... It's a bit of a tight connection for me because, I mean, I don't see why, you know, while it's possible for USF1, it was the right thing to do, but it's not what will happen. That's what I think. It was the right thing to do, but, you know, USF1 should have been a bit more practical and probably gone for, you know, instead of basing themselves mainly in Charlotte, they should have still based themselves in the UK and then maybe used the U.S. as a secondary base, but I don't think it'll happen. It's probably just a sheer coincidence that the two are connected. Because if they were connected, they should have been scheduled on the same day, not on two different days. At least that's how I see it.
What are you expecting to hear on Tuesday?
Just a thought, actually, that entered my thought earlier. If they're going to get like a Marco Andretti or a Danica Patrick, and they'd have to clear that through with AGR, and then they'd want, you know, they'd clear that through with Tony George. I wonder how that would affect negotiations for a U.S. Grand Prix in Indy. I'm sure it's going to have at least some effect in terms of will we finally see F1 return to Indy? with USF1 in 2010. That is a real possibility at this point, because I mean, what the point of, you know, USF1's support will only really grow if number one, of course, number one, they have to be successful, and number two, if they're going to, you know, if they're going to have a chance to build a group, a fan base of support, and that won't really happen unless we see F1 back in Indy.
And do you think this might throw a lifeline also to the Canadian Grand Prix?
Possible, but the connection is not as strong, obviously, because the Canadian Grand Prix would only come back if the Indy talks fall through again. But if there's going to be a USF1, I don't see those talks falling through this time. Somebody else will have to save the Canadian Grand Prix, not the USF1.
Andy, haven't spoken to you in a while. What do you make of USF1?
Well, first of all, I think it is a coincidence. I don't think there's any link between USF1 and whatever becomes of Honda. Just that statement on their website that says that it's American technology, American drivers, American competitive spirit, that doesn't really fit with Honda and Japan. Doesn't seem right to me.
But then neither does Spain in Venice.
Yeah, but they've got to have somewhere that's closer to the action, so to speak, with where the rest of the teams are located.
Sure.
A lot of American companies make their stuff in China, so really it would be no different to have an American company that makes their cars in Spain.
absolutely true. And in fact, that was another thing I looked at when I saw this. It's American technology, American drivers, American competitive spirit, Chinese manufacture. It's a bit like the rest of the world industry, really. But the thing about the launch, I think that there's going to be lots of flag waving and bells and whistles and, hey, look at us, aren't we great? Very little substance. It's too early to see a car, or at least a real car. We might get some pictures of, what's it called, artist impressions, that's it. Those animations they do for space missions. And then there'll be very little to talk about until this time next year, I would imagine.
Do you think that we're going to see some kind of a similar effort that we saw from Toyota, whereby they run a team and they basically follow the Formula One paddock around the world, but at a slightly different interval, so they can get an experience of all the tracks?
I guess they're going to have some sort of presence at certain places. They probably maybe send out PR people to be at the races. Say, by the way, guys, we're going to be here next year. Just so you know. But as far as testing goes, yeah, it's a very good point. I hadn't really thought of that.
Do you think if they agree to sign up to FOTA, they might get, you know, something in return, like some data, or, you know, we'll give you a hand, maybe?
Of course, all the teams love one another now, don't they?
Mostly. Officially.
I suppose that's a possibility.
Do you think Bridgestone will be able to help in any way? Because do they have any association? Presumably they have some association in the States with Bridgestone. They run Firestone in the US. So I wonder what the tyre allocation is going to be and whether Bridgestone will be helping them in any way, shape or form once they get running. So is anybody out there expecting anything? Is any of us expecting anything other than a bit of a press conference and some artist impressions on Tuesday? Is anyone expecting some kind of secret car to be wheeled out, or are we not that far?
I'm expecting a theme tune, a cool-looking drawing, a lot of American flag waving, and an artist impression of a car, and what someone said in the comments, hello, this is our logo, thanks for coming. I think that's brilliant.
I think
Bustano Clapper said that.
I think Luke in the comments said he's expecting a parade as well. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ticker tape parade. Mm. That would be something. Well, that'd be worth tuning in for.
They could employ the people who did an NFL Super Bowl halftime show and do it with an F1 car.
Cheerleaders.
Buy an old one, paint it with an American flag, get the cheerleaders and just like do some burnouts in a car park or something.
We're none the wiser on drivers, are we? Anyone care to throw any speculation into the hat of who you think is going to be driving for them? And will they announce any drivers on Tuesday or even a single driver on
Tuesday? I think I've got some speculation that could be Marco Andretti. And the reason is because he's currently driving an A1 Grand Prix. And Andretti Green have said that they're only getting into run, and because Andretti Green run the American Formula, American A1 GP team there, they said that they are getting him experience on road courses now so he can be better. But I think that maybe there's more to that. I think maybe that they could give him experience on road courses so that maybe they can try and help him out in towards a step up for Formula One, maybe. Yeah.
Fair enough. We haven't really got any other to know.
Well, Bassano said Danica, which is the obvious one.
I don't know. I don't know why. Only for Mark.
I mean, we talked about this last time, didn't we?
You wouldn't announce her this early, would you? It'd be too
she
much.
Said they haven't talked to her anyway, so.
If you were launching a team in a year's time, you wouldn't talk up Danica now because her price would just go up by the day.
She also said she didn't want to travel the world, so welcome to F1.
She doesn't want to travel the world?
No. Quite likes the US.
I didn't hear that. That's funny. And when I say funny. okay, anything else to cover on US F1 before we move on to other topics?
Well, I was just going to say about US F1 and their involvement possibly sort of reigniting the US Grand Prix and maybe even the Canadian Grand Prix. And SidePodcast had a post up, I think it was yesterday, talking about TV viewing figures around the world from the Paddock magazine, I think. And the question in the post was, you know, does Bernie sort of follow the TV viewing figures and therefore the money? Or is it sort of like the other way around and or how does it all work? I think it's interesting that that US F1 could sort of reignite the passion of Formula One in America. But I personally don't see that happening. I don't think that's entirely the way Bernie works. And I believe there are other things which influence Eccleston as to where the cars are racing. I think probably more to do with sort of future markets and like how Bernie has gone more towards Asia and China and all these markets that have been proven, as opposed to markets which are existing, like in Western Europe and America. I was just wondering if anyone had any more thoughts on that sort of side of things about specifically US F1, USGP, and viewing figures and Bernie.
It's all maybe coming to the fact that Bernie wants to go into loads of different areas. I mean, what was it? We've got this season, we've got Abu Dhabi coming in, and then next season we've got India and Korea. I think eventually Bernie's going to want so many races in so many countries that by at one point there's going to be no more countries that's going to be, you know, that hasn't had an F1 race. I mean, probably going to be racing in somewhere like Namibia or something, or Senegal or something, or some race, just because Bernie wants to tick off another country on his map of places where he's held a race.
I mean, Ollie's raised a really good point in that, because I mean the viewing figures were very telling, and if you get into a situation whereby, like you have in Germany, where the races are now dropping off because of Michael Schumacher, because you don't have the winner. If Alonso doesn't do well this year, Spain's going to be in pretty serious trouble in terms of their viewing figures, especially if they sort of all turn back to MotoGP.
Spain got into Formula One on television because of Alonso. Mm. And I can tell you, apparently they didn't have it on TV before Alonso came along, which is a bit weird because they had another couple of drivers like De La Rosa and so on. But my Spanish colleague is into Formula One, but he will not watch a race if he doesn't think Alonso's got a good chance of winning. He's very... Really? Black or white in that respect. And yeah, so therefore he hasn't watched many races last year. But he, to the point where he watched the Valencia race and turned off when Alonso crashed. So if that's any indication of what they're like with their support, then they could have some big problems with numbers.
Well, the interesting thing is that Japan seemed to follow, you know, Sato, even if he's at the back. But somewhere like Germany, they've got five drivers, but they still don't care unless it's Schumacher winning all the time. It's like a different mentality.
That's a good point. That's a very good point, because this year, potentially, they've only got Nakajima to cheer on in Japan. And they're still crazy for Formula One, and the figures are still on the way up. And, you know, they have a great response.
They've been mad on Formula One for years, though.
Well, that is true. But why do you think that is? And why do you think it doesn't translate to Germany?
I think Japanese people must just be more fanatical about the sports they follow. I mean... I can't explain Germany, because they've got five decent drivers and they've got very good coverage. Mm. I don't speak much German, but you can tell the coverage is good. It's got loads and loads of stuff.
They've got the most hours coverage of all the countries.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of people analysing it, a lot of interviews, a lot of technical stuff. It's very much like the ITV coverage in terms of what you get for your money, so to speak. But even when Schumacher was doing well, he wasn't always recognised as the best sportsman in Germany. I think one year when he won a championship, he came third out of their sports person of the year behind a skier and a cyclist or something. So maybe it's just a mentality thing that Formula One, although it's followed, isn't followed as much as football, for example, because they're really mad on football there.
Well, in the case of Germany, what I do find interesting is that, yeah, you're right, after Schumacher retired, the figures went down, even if they have five drivers now. I do expect it to go back up when Vettel starts really getting into the groove of things, starts winning more often. I think those viewing figures will go back up. But I think it's just a matter of them being, you know, but let's be honest, they got very spoiled with, you know, with Schumacher winning how many years in a row. You know, if they've really set those kinds of expectations with this current crop of drivers, then they really will get, you know, they really will be in for a disappointment. Japan, I think, is more of an exception than the rule. Because let's face it, let's look at, for example, what's with another country? Australia. Australia has Mark Webber. Has Webber's presence in the sport really affected their ratings? No. When will it start to affect their ratings? When he starts winning, when he starts really doing, you know, when he starts performing consistently. And before, you know, and until that happens, the form, you know, their form, you know, their audiences really won't go up. And I think that's the same kind of thing we'll see in the U.S. In the U.S., where, you know, where there are really a lot of professional sports leagues, unless USF1 starts winning races and titles, we won't really see a big upsurge in, you know, in U.S. popularity because of an American presence on the grid.
It will take a lot to make up for Bernie, won't it? He hasn't treated them well.
Also, you can liken USF1 to an America to Australia in that respect, because in Australia, the biggest form of motorsport is basically V8 supercars, which is gruntier versions of touring cars, and that's what the masses will watch. And Formula One is more of a sort of what's the word for it? It's more of a sophisticated version of the sport, and so it's not followed as much. And I think it might be the same in the States. You know, everyone likes NASCAR, and if they have even if this USF1 team does well, I think it will be not as well followed as NASCAR.
Do you think Bernie should be doing? Do you think Bernie can do anything to improve ratings?
Well, regarding sort of online viewing, wasn't there a bit of a spat recently between Max Mosley and Bernie Eccleston? By Max said he wants to embrace the internet more. And then Bernie responded with, well, it's not entirely down to him anymore because he sells the rights to show the footage, the broadcasting rights to all these companies around the world, ITV or BBC or Speed in America or whatever. So it's not actually down to Bernie to make these decisions, apparently.
So he's washed his hands of it. He said, okay, I've sold the rights to these people and it's up to them to make it better.
That's what it sounds like, and I think that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
if anything,
take A1GP for example, who stream the races online for those who can't see it.
Yeah, it should be live on the F1 official website. I mean,
let's go back to what you said, Molly. Let's go back to what you said. Bernie sells TV rights around the world. It's not in his interest to make it available online, is it?
But he could.
Bernie's
saying, well, I've sold the TV rights around the world and therefore I can't put it online. But that's rubbish, isn't it? Because he sold the television rights, which is a terrestrial or digital license, but he hasn't given away the rights, has he?
No, he sold the rights.
I was
surprised to hear that F1 was available in 90% of the worldwide's homes, because I can't see how that would be the case. There'd be so many countries I can think of which wouldn't have any interest or could afford Formula One. I mean, even like I've lived in Denmark and New Zealand and they've had coverage issues because of the amount of the cost. And these are civilized countries. So what about lots of other countries that don't have that kind of money to pay for it? They're not going to have the coverage rights to see it, are they?
Well, it depends what available means. If available means accessible, if you have the money to pay for it, then it might be. It's not saying that every single person has paid for that access, I would assume. But
watch it. You buy a ticket. It's as simple as that. Bernie makes his money by selling the rights to different companies around the world. And if you can get it online, even if it's on a subscription basis, there's no way that you're going to make the same amount of money. It's the same as with the International Olympic Committee, where their requirements are so stringent that athletes aren't even allowed to post on the internet while they're in the Olympic Village.
But they did stream online.
They did this last year.
Yeah.
But they haven't done it previously.
But presumably they find a way to make money out of television licenses and broadcast rights, but still managed to broadcast it online.
What I think they should do is, like, you know, Bernie shouldn't stream it. He should make the broadcasters stream it themselves. You know, I mean, it's part of, you know, it's part and parcel of the contract they buy, similar to what ITV did, and similar to probably what the BBC will do as well. You know, I mean, they have the infrastructure, they have the technology. Why don't they stream it online for their own viewers?
That's true, but part of me still thinks it should be on F1.com. There should be a means of going to the official website and looking at the official stream, shouldn't there?
Hey, look at someone like me, who lives in a broad country. Someone said to me, if you paid a fee, you could watch Formula One online in English. I'd be in front of the queue. Mm. Simple as that. There must be so many people like me. I mean, in continental Europe, there are a lot of people who buy English Sky to get English programs. Yep. And part of that is football and other things. Why do these sports not have a means where you can pay to watch the stuff online?
There is a demand for it.
It makes so much money.
Yeah, there is a demand for it because you can see from the Justin TV viewers that we were following last year, there were thousands and thousands of people watching each stream to the point that the stream wasn't working anymore. That's money that Bernie is losing there. There's an argument to say that not every single one of those people would pay Bernie for the privilege, but there is a demand out there that he's not even investigating.
Exactly, and
probably
it's
because it's not in his
Bernie best. Must think yeah, he's going to lose money if he does this on the internet, but he's not seeing, like a lot of media and stuff that's become available online for free in various means before it was paid for. The big corporations and tycoons don't see how they can make money for it until it's too late and they've lost a lot of money and then they finally get into it.
Well, I can sort of see their point because we don't make money from this. You know, it is difficult to make money online. It can be done, but it's not easy. And it's very difficult for big media companies to make the transition from, you know, TV, adverts, subscription-based models onto what they perceive as being, you know, free, giving it away for nothing.
Isn't MotoGP and NASCAR shown online?
And IndyCar for a paid fee.
But A1GP is free. That's correct, isn't it? Would you get more
only in the countries where you can't get the coverage?
Right. Okay. Well, that would be helpful. If F1.com did that, that would be helpful.
There can't be any reason not to show it. And like Gavin said, you know, if people want to pay for it, let them. There can't be any reason to not do that.
The only good reason I could think is if not enough people paid for it to make it pay. But then Bernie gives us lifetime for free when it works.
And it wouldn't take that many people to cover the infrastructure behind that.
No. No, it wouldn't. I mean, he'd have to do the figures, and maybe he's done the figures and they don't add up. I am curious as to Max's defense of our viewing habits. Another shot across the bow at Bernie, or do you think he really has an interest and he really thinks we should be watching F1 online?
Well, if I may say something, Bernie's already tried once to get Formula One to the masses via kind of, you know, some kind of interactive service, and that was when he launched back in 1996. He launched F1 Digital Plus, and that was kind of a way to try and, you know, get Formula One to the masses.
It wasn't really getting it to the masses. It wasn't getting it to the masses, though, was it? That was what Bernie tried to do, was provide a high quality and highly interactive service to people who want to pay for it. It wasn't
like
available.
Extras.
Yeah, it wasn't available. It was for the Uber fan and the people with a lot of money and a Sky service. It wasn't available to everybody on terrestrial. It wasn't like here's a really cool way to watch Formula One and everybody can now do it. It's here's a really cool way to watch Formula One and wouldn't it be nice if you could all afford to tune in?
Well, and not just that. I mean, this is when it was available freely on ITV, and then they were charging something daft like £20 a race or something really high to have this instead of ITV. Who's going to do that? I mean, we're talking about something different here. We're talking about a small fee to watch it online in a country where you can't watch it the way you want to watch it.
Or to pay a small fee to... I wouldn't mind watching it in a country where I can watch it on TV.
We'd pay for that.
You guys are watching online. Scott watches it online. Lots of other people watch it online because it's more convenient to do that, to watch it like with the timing and side podcast, for example.
I mean, if we could do a show and we could sit here and we could watch it and then just do another show at the end of the race without even leaving the room,
that would be heaven.
That would be bliss. And we can do that to a certain extent with ITV, but it isn't as good. The service isn't quite as good as it is on the TV. It's behind, which is a problem when you're watching live comments, because obviously if people are watching the TV stream, they're ahead of you. And that was a big problem last year with ITV and the main reason why I didn't follow it. And the thing is, it wasn't in ITV's interest. You can't palm it off onto the TV companies because it's not in their interest to make the online experience better when what they want to do, or the BBC aside, what they want to do is sell advertising on their television show. It needs to be Bernie making the call and making it happen. I just don't believe he sold the rights, the online rights, when he sold the television rights.
If he wants to palm it off on the TV broadcasting people, then he needs to mandate that they have an online presence as well.
He should do that. And RTL do, don't they, in Germany? There is another streaming, as well as ITV last year, RTL were doing some online streaming. But it needs to be done in every country. I am curious, though, as to Max's interest. I do not understand why he's so keen for us to watch it online.
Well, I think Max has perhaps finally realised that there is a huge audience out there. I mean, as much as we berate Max for what he does to the rules and regulations of the sport, I think he is aware of the online audience. I think it was a couple of years ago he admitted that he occasionally reads these sort of unofficial private blogs around F1 on the internet, which kind of shocked quite a few of us. we all started behaving ourselves. No, yes. I'm not sure if he actually does or if it was just something he said or maybe a misquote or whatever, but I think Max is clever with certain things and he is aware that there is a demand and an audience online. But I think someone mentioned earlier, maybe it's just a bit of sort of an infight between him and Bernie. Maybe they're just winding each other up, or maybe they even have a sort of a larger plan that they're working on in the background. I don't know, but I think Max should be given some credit for what he said regarding the online viewing. But he's just not the man who can make it happen, though.
I did notice Bassano said, is that why the BBC got the coverage this year? Because of their non-TV plans? It may have been.
Did Bernie? I don't know. Because Bernie, well, I don't know, because ITV were doing online last year. They weren't doing a very good job of it.
Doesn't seem, I mean, the BBC plans seem to be more extensive, although we haven't seen anything yet.
Yes. And we'll know more about that very soon.
But I thought that the reason BBC got it is because ITV pulled out, because they were focusing on the Champions League.
Yeah, it couldn't have come as news to ITV that football is more popular in this country than Formula One. And also, there was a chance that Lewis Hamilton would become world champion, and that would put up the viewing figures. To have a Formula One champion in this country, more people would be interested this year. So how come the ITV have been building up to Hamilton as a champion all this time, and then just as it's about to happen, suddenly say, actually, not what we really wanted at all.
Maybe it got too expensive. I mean, they had sponsor problems, didn't they? And as a commercial company, it could have been tricky.
It seems to be all too common, doesn't it? I think there was a podcast that you did, I think the one about going to France, where you mentioned the fact that there were all these unsold cars in the whole debate. It's like, yeah, of course, loads of people watch Formula One. That's why our prices are so high.
Yes. Come advertise to us and you'll sell more cars. Although it doesn't seem to work for Honda.
Well,
Honda have a history of just pulling out the sport when it gets too hard for them.
That is true.
And they just did it to save face. They lost loads of car sales. They knew they had to close the factory and sack all the workers, and so they couldn't have at the same time spend all that money on a losing Formula One team. And so it was a great excuse to say, "Oh, I've had enough."
Okay, but then looking at it from an isolated perspective, why spend all that money getting Ross Brawn and, you know, really building up for 09 if you're going to pull out before 09 anyway? That I found that a bit impractical, a bit odd. I mean, which makes me think then that their pullout from F1 was just a purely short-term move just to generate positive PR, just so that it would cancel, you know, they're closing out the factories and laying off of workers.
Okay, well, Junior, then, would you say that Honda pulling out of F1 has given Honda or F1 good PR? Because I don't think so.
Well, you would have to consider that, what if, you know, if Honda decided to stay in F1 while laying off people and shutting down factories, these groups would then be saying, if you're shutting us down, why shut down the non-essentials like F1? I have to look at it from that perspective as well. I mean, not everyone is a big fan of F1, so other people would think it's just unnecessary spending when they could just be spending it on making new production road cars, for example. At least, you know, I'm saying this from their perspective.
Okay, no, it's a fair point, but then to play devil's advocate here, Toyota and Renault/Nissan and various other companies have sacked workers, and they haven't pulled out of Formula One. And also NASCAR, all the big three, and Toyota as well, they're in NASCAR. They've had loads of trouble and fired loads of people, and they're not pulling out of the sport. So this is why I'm saying it's nice that they're using that as their excuse, but the real reason is that they sucked. They knew they sucked, and they had to get out to save face, like they've done the last couple of times they've pulled out of Formula One. And that was the great political excuse was, oh, we're losing a bit of money, we're sacking a few workers, it doesn't look good.
Well, they've really been away from Formula One, because even though they kind of left the sport in like 90, in whenever it was, kind of like 92 or something like that, as a major manufacturer, it was still around in some form. Because even though there wasn't a factory, it wasn't like proper main Honda engines, there were still Mugen Honda engines. And so you can't really say that Honda pulled out completely, because there's still been some influence in the term of Mugen.
I mean, Mugen, I'm sure Ron Dennis would disagree with you with his 93 Formula One car. They pulled out on him. They pulled out of the deal and left him in so much in the poo that he had to buy a customer Ford Cosworth engine. He couldn't even get a works engine in time. That to me is a pullout.
But I think they even got the better, more timing in the 1990, in the 1992 Honda pullout. I think they were able to tell Ron Dennis like 6 months in advance. The reason they had to end up with a customer Ford deal was because the deal with Lamborghini fell through for some reason or another. The Lambo engines were supposed to be the engines for 93, and Ayrton Senna tested those, but for some reason that fell through. The thing I think with Honda that we can all agree on is that they pull out when they're a team that was founded with racing in mind, and yet they seem to pull out when they find it convenient, even more so than Renault or Toyota have been in previous years. They've already pulled out. This is actually already their third F1 pullout, and I just find it. I'll go back to my earlier point. I just find it very weird that they spent so much money and time to prepare for 2009, only to pull out 3 months before it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm sure if they had wanted to do things properly, they could have told. Nick Fry and the whole of Brackley months ago that this is what they wanted to do. It just seems all rather sudden and emergency or evacuative.
It is panic, isn't it?
Yeah, panic, rather than doing things properly and planning it and selling the team or some other way of transferring the team. It's like they just want to just pull the plug, cut their losses, right, we're off.
And they're not even doing that very well. I mean, if they organise their team the way they're organising this exit, it's not surprising they ended up where they did, is it?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually. I mean, BMW did pretty well in the championship last year. Renault didn't do quite so well, but they've got Alonso, who's obviously providing them a lot of coverage. Honda were kind of a bit, but rubbish. And
they're a joke.
They've effectively said, okay, we're not getting anywhere, we're not improving, whereas the other teams, I think, are still improving, still competing, and they've just gone, let's just stop now. We've got other things to worry about.
Was it a bad move for them to come back? Should they have bought BAR?
Yeah, I think they probably should have bought BAR. Maybe they should have invested somewhat differently in it and developed the car in a different way.
Talking of investment, actually, Matt W. just pointed out a very good point that Renault actually have a sponsor at the moment, which obviously helps.
Actually, that's another good point, and we've talked about that quite a lot in the past about the whole Earth Dreams thing. It's not like they're actually getting anything in return for their outlay, whereas the other teams are getting money in from their sponsors.
Well, let's face it: if Honda is like the type of team that has no sponsor, that has to get Simon Fuller to create them a marketing scheme, so it's not obvious they don't have a sponsor, and they hired for a designer, they hire a guy that designs motorcycles rather than cars. Isn't this all isn't it obvious it's going to all go a bit pear shaped there? You're right. It's just the things that they've been doing actually ever since they won in 06, the last 2 years. Most of the things they've been doing, other than hiring Ross Brawn, almost none of them made any sense whatsoever.
Everything Honda. I'm sorry, Lou, I know you can't speak and defend yourself here. I do not understand why she liked Honda. I mean, other than the Jenson Button thing, there is nothing to like about the team. They're run by idiots. They made so many bad decisions. The only good thing about them is the drivers. And it's just, they're just, I'm just so happy they're not in Formula One. I just hope someone buys the team, sacks all the idiots, and gets someone good to run it, because I'm just so happy they're not in it anymore.
I love it. On that note, I think we should leave the Honda story. One more question is, this past week and the week before, three teams left Europe. They headed off to Bahrain to do some testing. They arrived in testing. It was a bit sandy, a bit dusty. There's a bit of a storm going on. They didn't get anything done meaningful for most of that week. They achieved absolutely nothing and then had to work twice as hard this week to make up for it. It doesn't strike me as a particularly useful way to save costs, especially if you're running away from the weather and running straight into it. Now, it could have been a one-off. It could have been a coincidence. Bahrain could be a really good place to go testing. Do you think the FIA should be mandating and restricting off-season testing in order to stop teams wasting money in such a grandiose way?
Firstly, this story made me howl with laughter because of what happened with Ferrari when they were supposed to be going to Portugal, I think, to the group test there.
It rained.
Ferrari, sort of like a day or two before the test was meant to commence, they sort of said, no, we're not going to Portugal because it's meant to rain. We're going to go to Mugello, a rain track in Italy. And then it poured with rain. then they do the same when they go to Bahrain and get sand instead. I think the Sakhir circuit in Bahrain is probably a reasonably good circuit to test on because it has a reasonably good mix of corners, which is what you want, which is why a lot of teams actually test at Barcelona, because it has high speed, low speed, long straights, short straights. It has a good mix of corners.
Sure.
But it's probably a very good venue to test that. But the fact that it's quite a long way away, and as you say, that adds to the cost of transport and everything over there and all the personnel. Should the FIA be limiting this? Well, they tried with the mileage limit, didn't they? I think it was something like 30,000 kilometres a year or something like that. Didn't always work, admittedly. Some teams perhaps found ways around it, or they sort of changed the agreement among the teams to sort of adjust that limit. But regarding where they test, well, I think because some teams manage to get around the mileage limit, it's probably not that easy to police, maybe. And it certainly would have been that way in the days before they had the ECU on the car sort of recording the mileage and everything. I think if the teams can afford it, then why shouldn't they go around the world testing? I mean, if that's sort of the advantage of being successful and doing well, it's like the survival of the fittest, and which is why I sort of don't really agree with other sort of monetary limits placed on the teams, like budget caps and everything. It is a case of survival of the fittest in my mind. If you do well, you do well. And if you don't, if you like Honda and you don't do well, then, well, tough. I don't know, though. It's a tricky subject. People like Frank Williams are probably going to get upset if some teams can travel this amazing circuit in the middle of nowhere and get some really good data and he can't afford to go. I can understand his perspective, but...
Do you not think, here's a wild thought, that they could, seeing as they're heading to Australia next, could they not just maybe go there earlier and stop off in Malaysia on the way or something and test there, and combine the travel costs with the expense of heading off in that direction? Why go to Bahrain, Bahrain is the fourth track on the season. They have no reason to be going out there and then coming back and then heading to Australia. Why not incorporate into part of the tour? So you have a worldwide tour during the season, race to race to race, and then in the off season you basically that continues, but all the teams then go to designated test tracks where the weather is almost guaranteed to be better, and then you incorporate that into the season.
Then that sort of means that the teams have to agree.
I've got a better idea,
and that would be common sense. Go on, Andy. which yeah. We know that common sense doesn't apply in Formula One.
Go on, Andy.
Eleonora in the comments says there is still a distance limit of 15,000 kilometres in force. Well, how about if that 15,000 kilometres distance included the distance travelled to get to the track and back again?
that would be brilliant.
Ferrari, that would be awesome.
Because we have the Fiorano circuit in their back garden, so they're all right.
Well, I don't.
There you go. That would work then, wouldn't it?
The FIA would approve of that.
I don't see why. Because when Kubica went to get that award thing, he drove along the road. Why can't they just do that? That would be brilliant.
What, driving up the high street?
Yeah.
Doing some straight.
I'd like
testing.
To get a picture of that.
They might have
the Lorenzo Bandini Award. Yeah,
that's right.
That's great and good PR as well for the team and Kubica.
Got to park it though. Clarkson and co had enough trouble with those supercars in Paris. So, I mean, the Formula One car would stand no chance.
The problem you have also is that at some point somebody's going to stall it, and then you can have a traffic jam on the motorway because some lunatic can't start his Formula One car by himself and some guy waits for a guy with a laptop to chase him. That's never going to work. You're not thinking this through at all, woman.
Sorry.
If I can just go back to the reason why they go out to Bahrain, I personally think it's because it's a good way for them to test and try to improve their reliability. Because Bahrain is always it's an extremely hot climate. I mean, of course, Malaysia is quite hot, but it's more humid than, you know, actual sheer heat. In Malaysia, it's more humidity, and that really kind of drains you. Out in Bahrain, it is actual heat, not just humidity, it is actual heat. And also, there's sand, and there's wind, and there's everything. Now, obviously, teams don't want to. I think the reason why they go out there, one reason, is to try and build up their reliability, because they want their parts to stand up against very high temperatures. They want them to stand up against things like, you know, sand possibly getting into the engine and the components, you know. And they also want to try and test out the aerodynamics against the strong kind of crosswinds which they normally experience over there in Bahrain, so that the cars, you know, they don't find any aerodynamic deficiencies.
So you think it's a good thing?
I don't see how it can be a bad thing, because obviously, you know, teams like Ferrari suffered quite badly because of the reliability of things such as their engines. Now, if they're out there in Bahrain, you know, going around there for a week, basically testing their car in what is probably going to be the hottest venue in terms of temperature, which they're going to be visiting all season, and they're basically testing their car to try and stand up those temperatures, then if they can stand up to if they can run maybe two or three race distances worth of testing, you know, over there in Bahrain, and you know, without any kind of engine problems, then that means their car can stand up to the most to the highest possible temperatures and kind of you know conditions in terms of intense heat and all those factors, and that maybe they might have an advantage over the teams which are testing over in Spain. Yes, Spain is hot, and also over there in Portugal, but obviously in Europe. At this time of the year, you're going to be experiencing rain.
Now, surely, what they experienced was sand. How much use can that be? I mean, what it told them is basically the weather reporting systems are unreliable.
It also tells them how good their systems are against sand corrosion, because that sand would get everywhere. I mean, in the lab,
how much use is that to a Formula One team? How much use is it?
It's no use at all. They would have had. I mean. Spoke to a soldier that worked in Iraq, and he said, biggest problem is, well, amongst other things, is the sand. He says, the laptops have to get taken to bits because the sand gets in them. They have to get cleaned out with compressed air. So a Formula One car running in those conditions, the sand getting in the radiators, into all the electrics, exactly. Into the engine.
At least
it'd be insane.
At least in Portugal, they got to try out the wet tyres.
Yes. There are no sand tyres.
No.
Maybe the FIA are overlooking that. It could be a thing for Bridgestone.
But I have to heartily agree with what Gavin's saying. Is that the fact is that if you're going out there, you don't want sand getting into the engine, you don't want to get into the radiators, you don't want to get into components, because sand will just clog up the components and it'll basically make them fail. So obviously, if you're out there driving the car in those kind of conditions, and also with the winds blowing across the sand all around the track and possibly getting into components, you want to try and find out ways to try and prevent that, but also at the same time, you know, not make the car overheat because of the temperatures and also because of the cooling.
But I would argue that there's only one of 17 races, only one of them is sandy. And therefore, if you're going to go and test something, you're better off testing wet weather tyres, aren't you?
I was going to say as well, Bahrain might be sandy and hot, but I mean, Malaysia is considered one of the hottest races of the year. There are some circuits that are very elevated. I think Fuji is really high up, like above sea level. And that affects the air and the way the engines run. So, yeah, why aren't they heading out to Japan and testing at Fuji or Suzuka or other places?
Or heading to Singapore, where they have to run at a different time of day or train their bodies to be at a different time of day. It might be good to get some practice in for that.
I mean, they'd have to close the high street.
Yeah, but
again, you're obsessed with running on the road.
No, I'm just saying it's another thing that, you know, if you're going to test for one specific race, that's another one to think about.
If they're going to be testing for the night, then why can't they just run test sessions at circuits like, I don't know, Valencia or Barcelona or Bahrain? Why can't they just run them at night?
Then it's freezing cold at the moment, and it'll be even colder at night. I mean, at least in Singapore at night, it was humid. You can't run in Valencia.
In the desert at night, it's really cold.
Yeah. Whereas in Singapore, it wasn't freezing cold, was it? It was still a hot ambient temperature. So they need to run somewhere where it's warm in the evening. And I don't know whether they find that. They could probably find that in Malaysia or somewhere. I don't know where you'd find that. You certainly wouldn't find that in Europe in February. Anyone got any more?
I wanted to say something about Toyota.
Go on.
And their performance in Bahrain, because I think that they're probably going to be a really good team to watch, because if you see what they did out there in Bahrain, they did something like 4 race distances in the space of 2 days. Now, I think if any team's going to be doing that kind of mileage in that space of time, then they are deadly serious about succeeding. I think that really they're going to be a dark horse.
To me, it was making up for lost time. But Journeyer?
It is the new. They are new rules, so it gives it's a level playing field. So if they understood the rules better than most, they'd have been, there's a good chance they'd have, that they have the car to do it. They definitely have the drivers and Julian Glock. So I don't see any reason why they can't replicate the form they had, for example, in 2005. But I think the real dark horses for 2009, Red Bull Racing, their speed has just been something else. They've been very quick. Other than the reliability concerns, which is always there with every Adrian Newey car, I think Red Bull is the team that, they might be finally able to get their first win this year, probably courtesy of Vettel, and a couple more race wins, would put them in very good stead.
Ollie?
Yeah, we're going back to the Toyota point and all their testing. Yes, they did look very good, but it's only in comparison to Ferrari and BMW and not other teams like McLaren and Renault. And testing, you should always take the lap times with a pinch of salt. You just don't know if Ferrari what were actually going for it, or if Ferrari were just, taking it easy and therefore...
Say sandbagging. Go on.
Yeah. Toyota definitely looked very reliable there, especially as people already mentioned on a circuit that is very dusty and windy, and the car looked pretty reliable. I think they did like 400 laps or something over the course of a few days, 3 days. Toyota improved quite a lot in 2008. I always sort of like joke about Toyota and question why they're in Formula 1, because they're not very successful. But then 2008, I kind of had to eat some humble pie. They did pretty well. But they're also a team that seemed to improve and then it all falls apart, much like BAR and Honda were in previous years. So I'm not going to stick my neck out and say I think Toyota are the dark horses. I think they'll probably just steadily improve in a similar way that they did last year. I don't think they're going to win any races or get any poles. Red Bull Racing, though, it's about time it all came together for them. I think this is, the second or third car that Adrian Newey has designed? It's about time he got it on the money. Of course, Mark Webber hasn't tested that much, though. I don't know if that's going to prove to be much of a problem for him. But they do have Vettel. He's a good thinker, a good racer, and it is really sort of setting the track alight at the moment. I would like to think Renault are going to be the dark horses, though, and that probably is sticking my neck out of it because they haven't done so well in testing so far. But Alonso did really well last year. He developed the car throughout the course of the season, won 2 races, the Singapore and Japanese Grand Prix, and proved that he can drive a car which maybe isn't the greatest on the grid and still do really well, get podiums and win races. So I think maybe with his talent and a car that has perhaps slightly improved over last year, hopefully, he can do better than 2 wins. He can maybe sort of drag the team up to the kind of levels that BMW are at the moment and maybe even sort of like move ahead of them, hopefully.
Nice one. Andy, what do you reckon? Who's your tip for 09?
I should be loyal to my local team and say Red Bull.
And your reasons other than living close to them?
Because they showed so much promise and because they're a team that seems to be going places rather than in the wrong direction. And because they're such fun people.
Good stuff. And Gavin?
I haven't got a clue. I really don't. Because every year we get these testing times that, for a few years we had Honda at the top and then we had Toyota at the top and then we had other teams at the bottom and last year we had BMW at the bottom. And it doesn't mean anything when we turn up at the Grand Prix. Teams are sandbagging, teams are trying illegal stuff, teams are going for glory laps. I've just got no idea. I really don't. I've got no idea who's got the 09 rules right and who hasn't. I mean, we've seen McLaren this week. There's been a lot of talk here about are they in trouble or not with Flovis and the old rear wing and that funny contraption on the side of the car. It could well be that they've actually got a good one and they've just... got a small issue or they're just trying something different. We just don't know. And I'm going to say, I would think that the top teams will still be the top teams from this year to last year, but I honestly haven't got a clue because testing so unreliable with who's actually got it and who hasn't.
Alrighty, okay. That's everybody, I think. Scott told us it was Toyota. You didn't have anything else to add to other for predictions for next year other than Toyota, did you, Scott?
Well, I think that the reason why I started Toyota is because they've been doing so much mileage and testing compared to really everyone else. I mean, looking at how much kind of, you know, distance and how much time and effort BMW and Ferrari put in compared to them is probably just a little bit insignificant. And I would have thought that maybe Toyota are really stepping up and saying, you know, we're now committed to Formula One, because they have missed that. They're committed to Formula One. And after all these years of, you know, basically just having this huge budget and, you know, not really going anywhere and, you know, trying to solve the problem, oh, we'll throw more money at it, see if that works. I think they've really now bucked their ideas up looking at some of the results that they achieved last year. They even got a third place in France and a second place in Hungary. And I think that's really kind of bucked their ideas up and thought, okay, instead of just throwing money at the project, let's now properly focus on, you know, building a good car. And, you know, I'm really going out there and getting as much data as we can to try and make it better. And I think that's really what the focus was. Because, I mean, you can't have a team that goes out and does, as I said, four race distances worth of laps and mileage in 2 days and claim that that's not them being serious.
But you can easily flip the mileage thing around, though, and say that perhaps Toyota are doing that mileage because they have some kind of problem that they're aware of and they're trying to iron it out, whereas BMW maybe haven't done as much mileage in testing because they're super confident and they know that their car is going to work and be a race winner next year.
As I said, I don't think mileage is an indicator. I mean, there are many reasons to run little or loads of laps. There's some funny rule with the amount of tyres and the amount of engines you can use this year, though, having said that. So I would have thought if that applies to testing as well, you wouldn't want to run heaps of laps unless you had to.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, one other thing I was going to raise, and it's vaguely related, but Williams spent, I think it was the week before last, most of the day running pit stop practice. So does that mean they're sus for this year? Are they that confident that they're going to iron out the pit stop, or do they think so much is going to be won and lost there? Why are they doing it was more than half a day. It was basically three quarters of a day running around in circles and coming straight back in the pits. And why would they be doing that?
Maybe they're just concerned about Nakajima's front wing coming off all the time.
But he was the one that hit the mechanic, wasn't he?
Maybe they're concerned about the mechanics. You wouldn't normally be doing pit stop practice this early in the winter test, would you? Because, I mean, they've got...
Unless they're practicing something with relation to KERS in a pit stop, like discharging the KERS or seeing how it reacts in repeated tests, you know, to charge it up, use it, come into pits and see what happens.
That's true. The only thing of note is they use both drivers. It was Nakajima started off and then Nico finished up. So it's almost as if it's related to how the drivers react to that as well.
Perhaps they've got the car so sus that they've run out of other things to do.
That's what I was thinking. I don't know. It just seems really unusual. Normally, I believe they do it on the last week of the last test. And they fly everybody out there to do their pit stop practices. And it's like an extended test and they get loads more people in there. And you'll probably see that people like Renault doing that at the very, you know, literally just before they all fly off to Australia to make sure they're all sharp. And I'm just really curious as to why they've done it so early. It may be nothing. It just seemed like a waste of a practice day.
Last thing I want to raise, something interesting, just not as big news as the others. Not sure if anyone here at the call here joined. You know, Singapore had races. Singapore kicked off two contests this week, both for fans. One is the one where they name turns 1, 7, and 10, I think. 1, 7, and 10, and then the other one is where they ask people to submit their best photo of the 08 race, and you know, both would get some great prizes still to get to watch the 09 race. It's actually something very interesting because it's the first time, I think, ever that I heard a circuit or a Grand Prix organizer actually organizing contests for the fans for the Formula One fans. And it's something, reading the comments on F1 Fanatic actually, this week, many people actually like that concept and were saying, why don't other circuits like, you know, Spa or Silverstone or even Suzuka, why don't they try something similar? I think the great thing about the Singapore contest was, one, it was there was actually a contest, and number two was it was actually a global contest, so not just local fans, but those anyone around the world can join. So my question, I guess, would be, what can other circuits do to emulate what Singapore did? What kind of contests or surprises can they have for fans to get them to support the race?
That's a good question, because a lot of motor racing series try and drum up support. We've got A1 Grand Prix with the countries and Super League Formula with the football teams. It's a very difficult thing to do. Having a team associate or a Grand Prix associated with something doesn't necessarily guarantee support. In the case of Singapore, there's a lot of buzz about the event, and the fact that the corners have no names anyway is a very big plus. But I can't see how a lot of the other Grand Prix would be able to do that so effectively.
Valencia.
Maybe
could.
More for the...
Well, we no, they've
just
them,
got numbers. Valencia
could work.
We've done that one.
It's interesting, the photography thing's interesting, because normally, certainly places like the Race of Champions, cameras weren't allowed. And people are frightened of letting fans in with cameras. So it's interesting that they're encouraging people to turn up with their photography equipment and snap. And then award prizes for the best photograph. So that's a good sign. I think that's a good step in the right direction.
Is that a general thing, though, that cameras aren't allowed at Formula One races?
I think they are allowed, but there are... doesn't Bernie own all copyright to everything that you take?
It's not encouraged, is it?
No, I think basically any photograph you take within the confines of a race week, racetrack during a race weekend is owned by Bernie, allegedly, although I don't think anyone's ever contested that. And presumably Singapore are assuming that it's not the case, because they're gonna take your pictures and they're going to award you a prize for it. So that's interesting. That's a different take on that. So,
I was just leading on for that. What does that mean if you post your pictures on Facebook or Flickr then?
Well, that basically, as far as we've had this discussion, it was a long time ago we had this discussion, but I think if you look into the legal things of it, you're not allowed to put your videos on YouTube and you're not allowed to put your pictures on Flickr. Now, as far as I'm aware, FOM are only ever chasing videos. And I'm not sure that their legal claim on the back of the ticket holds water, but it does say on the back of the ticket that any photographs taken within the confines of the circuit during the race weekend are copyright to FOM. And not even the circuit that sell you the ticket and let you in the gate. FOM owns it. I don't know of one single person who's ever been asked to take a photograph down because of it, because I don't think it would hold water in any country.
Because the other thing about that is Red Bulletin last year were paying fans that had good photos to be published in the Red Bulletin newspaper thingy they were printing on site.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
In fact, when they tried their social thing last year, had an area of their site where you could upload fan photos.
Actually, I thought you were going on a different storyline there, but no. With they do have and also Force India also have a club Force India where you can upload photographs. But whether or not they don't specifically say they shouldn't be taking it at circuit or not. What I thought you were going to mention actually was the fact that Renault's podcast got axed and banned from being recorded at the circuit because Bernie wouldn't allow them to record audio in the paddock and then release it onto the web. So what they have to do now is go to a hotel room or go to the factory and record their podcast.
What? How does that work? Because then you've got the F1 inside line, which is the Telegraph
it's
or
not,
the Observer.
It's not. It's in a cafe or it's outside. It's nowhere near, it pretends or it doesn't say that it isn't at the circuit, but it's nowhere near the circuit. Same with Williams. Williams used to record in
and the checkered flag one then?
Yeah, no, that's different. That's different. They've got
that's BBC. Official, isn't it?
They've got rights to record at the circuit, so that's done in the press conference area normally. However, the Williams podcast used to be from the motorhome, and they used to say we are live at the track, and now they can't. And the same with the Renault one. That used to be recorded on the
pit. But the inside line one is done at the circuit, because it's often done with Ian Phillips from Force India, and they often point out that the Force India boys are packing up shop behind them.
Dodgy. I don't know if they may have some kind of different thing because Morris is on the BBC, but I'm pretty sure they're not allowed to do that. They're supposed to. They may record it there, but they're not allowed to say they're recording it there. And normally it's just in an anonymous location. But I'd be interested to know where they do say that, because that would be worth looking into. I'm pretty sure Bernie doesn't know about it. But he came down...
It's implied that it's at the circuit.
Oh,
anyway,
it's implied. It's absolutely. Not. But it's not... If it is recorded there, they're not. They can't say that it is. The difference is in the Williams one, a couple of years ago, they'd say, oh, here we are in the paddock and walking by is Gordon Ramsay. What are you doing, Gordon Ramsay? He said, oh, I'm really enjoying it. I'm walking up and down a paddock and I've got this little tab here and isn't it excellent? I've just had my photograph taken in the car. That's what they used to say. And Bernie came down on them and said, you're not doing that anymore. I own all the rights to all the audio recorded within this paddock at any point, even after the race is finished. So on a Sunday night, I still own it. Go outside the paddock and record it, and that's fine. And for a bit, they went to a hotel room and didn't really have the atmosphere. And now the Renault go to the factory in Enstone, I think, mostly, and do theirs there. which is
Renault have the round table, didn't they? And Williams do like little interviews with various staff at the factory and things
and
like that.
I think Williams do interviews at press days, like on the Thursday and the Friday.
Yeah.
And they did the thing with Wurz where they phoned Wurz up in his hotel room. So no, there's no rights. Even Formula One teams cannot record audio at a Formula One track on a Formula One race weekend because Pirelli won't let them. So I'm amazed that fans who don't even have paddock access are allowed to take pictures and then upload them to
and win something. Yeah, that's the main thing, isn't
it? That's quite a turnaround.
I think Bernie might, you know, let it go if no one gets anything from it. Like, he doesn't mind your pictures going on Flickr, you know, but if you're going to go and win something from it, he might have something to say about that.
Yeah. Anybody got anything else to say? Before we go, anybody got anything to promote? Ollie?
Other than the usual blog F1, my little corner of the internet, I haven't got any big plans coming up this week other than maybe a post about Elio De Angelis, a driver who was very charismatic in the past and sadly died while testing. That's along the lines of my new Velari post as well. So that should be something to look forward to.
Most certainly keep our eyes out for that.
Fantastic.
And I think Christine liked one of your posts you wrote. Was it yesterday or the day before? One she linked to. Which was...
The happy side of Formula One or the...
We need more of that.
It makes a change from all the depressing news, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Who else we got on the list? Scott, you have a blog.
Yes, but I don't want to plug that. Instead, I want to plug a book I've been reading. It's really interesting. It's called Inside the Mind of the Grand Prix Driver.
Okay, who's that by?
It's by Christopher Hilton, who's the same guy who wrote the book about, wrote a really interesting book about Ayrton Senna.
Nice one. So do you recommend this book?
Yeah, it's got some really interesting stuff on how racing driver's minds work, how they think about the media, how they get into a good mindset. There's a good thing about Carl Benninger using concentration techniques to visualise lap times, and he'd be actually able to drive them for the closest tenth of a second.
And how much is it?
It depends. I bought it off Amazon. It was about £10 off Amazon.
Good stuff. Alrighty. Andy, you got anything to promote, sir?
No, I haven't got anything to promote, but I'll put a plug in as somebody on the comments. I think it might have been Lou. If you don't read anything else about Formula One this week, go and read Stephen Roy's article.
Yes.
Sidepodcast.com about Gilles Villeneuve, because it's excellent.
It is excellent. And I haven't actually commented on it yet, but I'm going to. And I really think that is an amazing piece of work. And we thank Stephen very much for letting us publish it, because it's an amazing piece of work. So thank you for bringing that up, Andy. Jernia, what you got for us?
First, if you have time, watch Weekend of a Champion, Roman Polanski, Jackie Stewart. Just watched it this weekend. It's absolutely incredible. We love the movie. It's brilliant. If you have time on your hands, do find a copy. It's great, great to watch. And as usual, my guest posts on F1 Fanatic, it'll be starting up in probably around 3 weeks' time.
Groovy. And Gavin, what you got for us, buddy?
Lou said she's going to write a post about why she loves Honda so much, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Lou is going to tell us why she loves Honda so much after you've spent the entire of the last 2 hours berating them. And saying they're not worth following. Is she gonna? She's gonna defend. She's gonna defend it. Is it?
She said if she wasn't so busy, she would have come on and had a rant.
Right.
But seeing as she can't, she's gonna write a post about it.
Okay.
Instead.
Is that on F1Break.com? I'm looking forward to seeing that. So if anyone's listened to the show, you might have to go and check out F1Break and see what Lou has to say to defend Honda against the might of Gavin.
It should be pretty easy.
She's taking me time. She sounds quite busy. Oh, that's excellent. Okay, I enjoyed this. Very much enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you, everybody, for being on the call.
Yep, thank you very much.
Yeah, good fun, yeah.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you.